11. Feeling and thinking. For the most part, personal experiences with DMT stay within the confines of one's own body and mind, the realms of feeling and thinking. As such, the phenomena we encounter are not very different from the sorts of things any psychotherapist hears in the office, body-based feelings and mind-based thoughts. Most of our volunteers more or less consciously hoped for a spiritual breakthrough with the aid of DMT, a final resolution to questions regarding why they were born, or a union with the divine in which all conflict ended and an unshakable certainty prevailed. However, DMT, as a true spirit molecule, gave our volunteers the trip they needed, rather than the one they wanted. Some research subjects resolved difficult personal problems during their sessions. Afterward, they realized that they had worked something through in a positive way and felt better. The basic processes of psychotherapy seemed to be at work: thinking, recollecting, feeling, connecting emotions with ideas. For most of us, facing painful feelings is difficult, and DMT can make those feelings easier to confront. Stan's DMT sessions, for example, helped him contact feelings too raw to touch in everyday consciousness. Dreams are a basic tool for any personal growth and understanding, and DMT may generate highly symbolic dreamlike images. Marsh's high-dose sessions are a beautiful example of how the spirit molecule can show us what we need to know using this particular facet of its power. For many of us, traumatic experiences set the stage for painfully blind reenactments of situations in which we face those same feelings over and over again. A high dose of DMT shares many features with physical and psychological trauma. We'll see how it is possible to turn these aspects to good use in Cassandra's story. I expected to see many volunteers working through emotional and psychological conflicts during these studies. Sessions of this nature might help prepare the way for psychedelic drug-assisted psychotherapy in patients. We would note how DMT affected volunteers in potentially beneficial ways, then build those effects into any subsequent psychological treatment protocols. The first generation of psychedelic scientists made such therapy projects the mainstay of many centers' research activities. We would essentially be doing little more than retracing their steps in anticipation of renewing their work in a contemporary context. I was ready for these types of sessions. I believed it was possible for the volunteers to reach some valuable insights into personal conflicts, difficulties, and psychosomatic symptoms by using psychedelics. In addition, many years of undergoing, practicing, and teaching psychoanalytic psychotherapy prepared me for dealing with the painful emotions I thought would emerge during some DMT sessions. Stan was 42 years old when we met, and he began participating in the DMT studies. His wife of 14 years was a respiratory therapist who worked with many medical patients at the research center. She thought he'd be interested in the project, and he gave me a call. He was one of the most experienced psychedelic drug users of anyone in our studies, having taken LSD over 400 times. "They don't call it acid for nothing," he laughed during our first meeting. He took LSD or mushrooms every few months, using them with several close friends with whom he shared a strong belief in their beneficial effects. Stan was married, had a young daughter, and held a highly responsible position in the local government. He was of medium height and build, good-looking and attentive to his appearance. He was rather disinclined to talk about his inner experience, and he stated his interest in the DMT studies in a typically concise manner: to further legitimate studies and for personal exploration. Stan's low screening dose of DMT, 0.05 milligrams per kilogram, was uneventful. Like many others, he felt an urge to smile early on in the session. The next day was Stan's high-dose session. Carrying my varied assortment of needles, syringes, and disinfectant swabs, I entered his room and found Stan sitting in cross-legged position on a meditation cushion with the back of the bed raised as close to a right angle as possible. He was one of the few people who felt better sitting up than lying down. Stan didn't say a lot about that morning's high-dose experience. Mostly, he was impressed with the power of the onset of effects. In fact, he thought he might even have liked a dose slightly higher than 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. He wasn't sure if DMT had any beneficial effects either. It's not as useful as LSD or psilocybin. It's too much, too fast. You can't really work with it. You're totally out of control. It wasn't a spiritual experience. There was very little emotional flavor to it at all. Regarding what he actually saw, all Stan ventured was that there were lots of kaleidoscopic blues and purples. Stan went through the dose-response study successfully, but without it making a particularly deep impression on him. However, he enjoyed participating in the research and wanted to be notified when the tolerance study began. About a year later, Stan signed on for the DMT Tolerance Project. A lot had happened. His wife had experienced a recurrence of her serious psychiatric illness and was filing for divorce. A very difficult child custody battle was developing, and their 8-year-old daughter was living with him. I wondered if the DMT sessions might provide him with some emotional clarity for these trying times. While the goals of the research remained unchanged, Stan was a fellow human being undergoing a major loss, and if we could help him within the project's context, all the better. As it turned out, his first double-blind day was active drug, 4 consecutive high-dose DMT injections. The first 2 doses helped him clarify the stress under which he'd been laboring. There were the usual colors. I guess I'll do the next several doses in spite of the anxiety. Gently teasing him, appealing to his psychedelic machismo, but also encouraging him to go a little deeper, I said, "I didn't think you'd have it any other way." He lay quietly with his eye shades on. "I like the eye shades. They've turned out to be quite helpful. Did you have any thoughts or feelings?" "I had some anxiety, more or less. I don't remember that from before." I offered the suggestion, "There's a lot more going on in your life now. I wonder if the anxiety is related to the uncertainty and loss of control in your life right now. This is a drug that causes loss of control. That might be uncomfortable." At 5 minutes after the 3rd injection, "There is a very slight nausea. I've noticed that nausea, in an altered state of consciousness, often is a way for the body to distract us from anxiety and sadness. During meditation or hypnosis, or on psychedelic drugs or even marijuana, it's somehow easier to feel sick than sad. I'm not going to throw up. Don't worry. Maybe it's the combination of anxiety and my sinuses. Part of my anxiety relates to my daughter's school next year. She's in 5th grade. I need to decide this morning. She's having a hard time with the divorce, especially having difficulties with her mom. It's hard on me, but it's harder on my daughter. I'm sure it's hard on your wife, too. It's a terrible situation." "Yes. I wish it were a higher dose, in a way. I could blast through it."
"Blow it out of the water?"
"Yes. Blow it out of the water."
"How do you feel about 2 more doses?"
He smiled. "I have 2 very opposite emotions, fear and anticipation of pleasure. Perhaps lying down, Stan might feel safer to give up some control, to throw up if he really needed to expel his inner emotional toxins." I asked, "Do you want your head down?" "I'm not sure it will make any difference, but okay, I'll try it. If I have to vomit, do you have something I can throw up into?"
"Yes, we have a waste basket. It's not pretty, but it has a wide mouth and we can catch it all."
After the 3rd dose was in, he took one of Laura's hands with his right hand and one of mine in his left. "I'm not sure about the 4th dose. I don't know if I can do another one."
"It's only been 3 minutes. Let's see how you feel in a little while."
At 5 minutes, he said in a humorous tone,
I will do a fourth for you, Rick. The third dose seems to be the hardest. You're just saying that.
Not really. People look bad after the third dose, and they look good after the fourth.
I guess I have a lot of unresolved feelings.
That makes sense.
That's easy for you to say.
I know. I'm sorry if I sound glib. Why do you think these things are unresolved?
The emotions are intense. They're there, but I think I'm shielding myself from them to get through the divorce. It's not entirely pleasant.
That's an understatement, I guess.
The emotional intensity builds each time, but I feel most at peace now.
That unresolved feeling is gone.
Maybe something's been done.
Maybe 15 minutes from now I won't be saying this.
At 10 minutes after his fourth and last injection, Stan blew through his pursed lips, then said,
"It's a much nicer ride this time.
It's like three waves you catch body surfing. They knock you down getting ready for the fourth, which is great. I want to do it again." We all laughed, relieved he was feeling better. In this man who kept so much to himself, his earlier admission of anxiety must have indicated intensely powerful feelings. He spent the next several minutes lying quietly, relaxing and basking in his newly found inner peace. Stan seemed refreshed and in good spirits after the fourth dose. He ate lunch and left quickly after finishing. Stan and I talked by phone a couple days later. He said, "I'm feeling fine. I felt some mild euphoria yesterday and today, probably related to the experience. I wasn't sure about continuing with all four doses. Something finally clicked and got resolved. Maybe it was surrendering. It really put me through some changes. The first one was mixed emotions. The second and third ones were overwhelming. Just a lot of unresolved anxiety. The fourth one really did it." I asked, "Was there any content to your sessions?"
"Very little. It's like a roto-rooter for your nervous system. It clears some things free. It was purely energetic. There are cumulative effects. Something happened. Something changed between the third and fourth doses. After the third, I just gave up."
Stan kept his feelings at bay. Like many of our volunteers, he enjoyed psychedelics because of their emotional intensity. He could feel something on high doses of LSD. Perhaps not pleasant or enjoyable feelings, but at least more than nothing. Anytime we find ourselves stuck in life, it usually is because we can't connect with the feelings that come with that situation. While in Stan's case, there certainly seemed to be a roto-rooter gradually wearing down his psychological resistance, there was a conscious processing that helped, too. He was anxious and uncertain. Although he knew what it was about at one level, the inner emotional contact just wasn't there. His free-floating anxiety was anything but nameless. His life was in turmoil, and simply making that interpretation helped him to start a process. The emotional power of DMT then drew it to some resolution. Stan's joking about taking his last dose of DMT for me, rather than for himself, pointed out an interesting conflict. We needed data, but we were also concerned with the volunteer's own needs. If Stan were having a clearly traumatic experience and seemed to be decompensating, we would have called off the study. But he seemed willing, on his own part, to continue, and we never seriously thought about stopping early. Nevertheless, his comment did have a ring of truth about it. The visual images volunteers encountered on DMT sometimes reminded them of dreams. And, as Freud said, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Looking at, thinking about, and discussing dreams may help us understand hidden emotions known only by the distressing symptoms they cause during ordinary wakefulness. Let's imagine that someone develops paralysis in his right hand, and multiple medical examinations reveal no physical problem. He's sent to a psychiatrist who asks him to remember his dreams. That night, our theoretical patient dreams of beating up his boss at work, The psychiatrist suggests that his paralyzed hand represents deep anger at the boss, rage that he didn't know he had. Maybe these are emotions he's afraid to feel because he doesn't know what might happen if he did so. A light goes on in the patient's mind, and he regains function of his hand. While such an example smacks of a Saturday morning cartoon program, it captures the essential process by which dream work can be personally helpful. Symptoms are not often as obvious as paralysis. They commonly include anxiety, depression, or relationship problems. The approach we took to supervising DMT sessions was as clinically neutral as possible, but ignoring psychological issues emerging from volunteers' experiences would have been negligent. Sometimes I had to decide quickly whether or not to take up the personal psychological thread a research subject had begun, whether to push that volunteer forward just enough to see some resolution to his or her confusion or uncertainty. I also had to take into account the risk that such comments or interpretations might cause some destabilizing effects in his or her life. In Marcia's case, for example, she was struggling with her marriage. Upon entry into the DMT study, Marcia was 45 years old, had been divorced twice, and had been with her current husband for 6 years. She was of African-American descent, while her husband was white. Marcia possessed a delightful sense of humor and frankness. Her mood was significantly better this past year than it had been for some time. She felt a great sense of relief after dropping out of a graduate school program she found dehumanizing and unsupportive of her racial and ethnic background. Continued problems at home, however, revolved around her husband being more depressed than I was, and she had been thinking of leaving him. Marcia had taken psychedelic drugs perhaps 30 times in her life, and she found them very mind-opening. She volunteered for our research to help out my friends, to experience this drug out of curiosity and wonder, to be challenged, and, because my husband can't, therefore he can vicariously share this with me. Her husband had slightly elevated blood pressure, which disqualified him. Marcia managed her low screening dose of DMT well. The next day's high dose took her completely out of her body. She was startled to find herself in a beautiful domed structure, a virtual Taj Mahal. I thought I had died, and that I might not ever come back. I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, bam, there I was. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Marcia described in great detail what she saw and how she was transformed during her experience. It was an extraordinarily pleasurable morning. We listened to her report and didn't need to add much. She enjoyed it. There was little conflict, and we shared in her happiness. Marcia later participated in the cyproheptadine study. When it came time for her fourth double-blind session, we were nearly certain, taking into account the effects of her previous sessions, that this final dose would be an unadulterated 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. She began by saying, I hope to meet some of my ancestors today to help me deal with my current life stresses. She talked about her marriage. Her husband had been in therapy and his therapist was telling him to be more honest with her. As a result, he told her he didn't like that she was getting fat, that it was a sexual turnoff. She wondered if I thought she was fat. I sidestepped her question and suggested, maybe there's more going on than just how much you weigh. She nodded, and we began preparing for the injection. A few minutes before giving Marcia the DMT, her husband entered the room, ready to join us for the session. The atmosphere in the room was slightly sad, but also hopeful. She began talking about 15 minutes after the injection. I never would have imagined it would be like this. There was no transition. There was no universe with stars and a pinpoint of light like last time. You know what happened? I was on a merry-go-round. There were all these dolls in 1890s outfits, life-sized, men and women. The women were in corsets. They had big breasts and big butts and teeny skinny waists. They were all whirling around me on tiptoes. The men had top hats, riding on two-seater bicycles. One merry-go-round after another. The women had red circles painted on their cheeks, and there was calliope music in the background. And there were some clowns flitting in and out, not really the main characters, but busier, somehow more aware of me than the mannequins. This sounded like a dream. It also was another encounter with clowns or jesters, something I had been hearing about for quite some time from other volunteers. However, they seemed less important than the merry-go-round and her feelings about it. We had been talking about therapeutic issues before the injection. I decided to put on my therapist's cap and see what happened. When someone comes into a therapy session recounting a dream, I usually ask, and did this time, "What did it feel like for you?" "That's the wrong question. Try another." At that moment, Marcia wasn't ready to do work with the dream, so I responded to the more superficial aspects of her experience, the carnival atmosphere. "Was it fun?" "Yes." "Could we go deeper? Was it really fun?" "Yes, but it was no Taj Mahal. I hoped to see my ancestors, a temple, or that I would see tall African people in old clothing. Instead, you were at a carnival at the state fair." "Big time. I was the only human there. They had these painted-on smiles. There was no change in their expression. I thought, hey, what's going on?" She added, "There was a sexual energy of wanting more, of being stimulated, of wanting more. I've never felt that way on DMT. I guess the mannequins were so beautiful that it was a turn-on." She lifted her eyeshades and looked at her husband, blurting out, "Let's fuck." I laughed. "Sorry, you'll need to wait until you get home." Her husband turned to me and said, "Do people have sexual experiences during DMT?" While a reasonable question, it did not quite fit in with the personal and emotional themes that were so active at that moment. I had to answer, but did so briefly and with the hope of regaining direction. "There's sexual energy, but not usually sexual intercourse types of feelings." I knew I had to act fast if I were to be of any help in interpreting the dreamlike features of Marcia's session. What was the spirit molecule trying to tell us? Were the mannequins white? Were they Anglo? Yes, they all were. There were no colored people in any of the things I've ever seen from the gay 90s. "It's interesting. DMT seems to have its own agenda. What do you make of this?" "I just can't figure it out. I'm exhausted and starved." I ventured, "They sound like an exaggeration or a caricature of Anglo beauty. It's interesting within the context of what you were talking about, your concerns about your weight." "It's true. Maybe I should have fun with my figure." She looked at her husband and said, "I told Rick about your thinking I was fat, that was part of your therapy." He looked a little embarrassed. "When I was young, I was quite thin. When my husband and I met, I was 20 pounds less than I am now. I looked like a stick figure. That's not my culture at all. Rather, the desired form is heavy and full. Big breasts and big waists and big rear. Skinny was terrible in my culture. They used a slang word that meant skinny, but when they used it, I didn't know what it meant. It seemed like they were talking about ugly, ill, not well." Marcia's husband excused himself to use the bathroom. Upon returning, he seemed to sense Marcia's need to talk about these things without him in the room, and he returned to work. She and I continued this discussion for a while longer, and then drifted onto other topics. I usually was not as directive with volunteers as I was with Marcia that day. However, her DMT vision seemed so perfectly related to her current conflicts that I could not ignore the message the spirit molecule was giving us. Marcia's Anglo husband was comparing her with his image of the ideal woman, and she was lacking. Her figure was not right. However, the mannequin Anglo women and men were lifeless, painted images, going round and round aimlessly. Marcia remembered the pride with which her family greeted the full figure of womanhood and tried owning that herself. She felt her inherent sexuality was good enough. She wanted to have sex with her husband to reconnect at that basic level. Surprised and nonplussed, it was difficult for him to address her emotional needs at that moment. It was a miniature version of their ongoing problems. Another way in which DMT affects the mind and body in potentially useful ways is through creating a controlled and supported traumatic experience. Trauma derives from a Greek word meaning wound. My dictionary defines trauma as a severe emotional shock having a deep, often lasting effect upon the personality. Traumatic experiences usually are out of our control. For example, we do not choose our abusive childhoods, exposure to natural or man-made disasters, or real threats to our life. Once we have experienced such events, the mind's natural tendency is to wall off the feelings of fear, helplessness, and anxiety that threatened to overwhelm us at the time. Nevertheless, unprocessed trauma seeps out into our lives. We may find ourselves in situations that produce ghosts or shadows of those trauma-based feelings over and over again. It is as if we feel forced to repeat certain types of relationships that bring out feelings we couldn't master or control the first time, usually when we were powerless children. For example, an abusive spouse recreates the feelings brought on by an abusive parent. We may notice it's difficult to make deep emotional attachments because being close means being dangerously vulnerable. If we are to move past the consequences of trauma, it is necessary to confront them head-on. Usually this requires a voluntary re-experiencing of the feelings caused by the trauma in a safe and supportive environment. The problem is how to access those feelings in the first place. In many ways, a high dose of DMT is traumatic, bringing about a loss of control and annihilation of personal identity. Shock is a word we heard many times during the DMT studies. I even began using the term when I prepared people for their first 0.4 milligrams per kilogram session. Several volunteers recommended we print T-shirts with the words, "I survived 0.4. to hand out to those who successfully negotiated that morning's events. I am certain that many of our volunteers were at some level attracted to the DMT project because it promised an overwhelming but structured voluntary traumatic experience. By experiencing absolute loss of control in a safe and supportive situation, it might be possible to more fully contact and thereby own and let go of certain painful emotions. Cassandra was one such volunteer, whose incompletely expressed and felt emotions from past trauma hindered her current life. Cassandra was 22 years old, the next to youngest volunteer, when she signed on for the DMT project. Her manner and appearance brought out conflicting feelings in most people she met, and I was no exception. She dressed and carried herself in a somewhat masculine way, and she was bisexual. Both men and women found her pleasing face and lithe, androgynous body type attractive. Her studiously casual attitude toward appearance and self-care made her seem somewhat waif-like, and it was easy to feel caring and maternal toward her. The older nurses on the research ward wanted to feed her and give her a bath. She also possessed sharp intelligence, laconic humor, and a direct manner. Cassandra was a complicated young woman, and it took some effort to see with whom you were really dealing. Cassandra suffered in relationships. Her parents divorced before she was a year old, and her mother raised her neglectfully. This came to a head at the age of 16, when her mother left her alone with her stepfather for a week. He raped her repeatedly during that time, and this cemented her stark ambivalence toward men and women, distrusting and hating them on one hand, but needing their love and protection at the same time. After this, she developed symptoms of a post-traumatic stress disorder, experiencing flashbacks of the rape during sexual relations in her first long-term relationship. When she was 20, she decided that she never wanted to have children, and had a tubal ligation. Cassandra had been in and out of many short-term therapeutic and romantic relationships. At first, she would idealize and romanticize the therapist or lover. Then she experienced disappointment and contempt in his or her inability to provide the empathy she needed so badly. She was friends with one of our male volunteers, and they became sexually involved after they completed the tolerance study. Soon after that, she left the country, leaving no forwarding address. I include Cassandra's story here, although it could also belong in the entity contact or mystical experience chapters. Her sessions did include interactions with the clowns and led to a deep, serene peace she had never previously known. However, the being's primary effect was to make her feel loved and happy, and the mystical resolution to her conflicts came only after a painful psychological process. Cassandra's sessions were, like many of the ones I will present, hybrids of more than one type. In addition, it felt as if I were doing psychotherapy with Cassandra, rather than spiritual counseling or interpreting transdimensional phenomena. So placement into the feeling, thinking, personal category of experiences relates to the type of response her session evoked in me as much as in her. She had few stated expectations of her participation in our studies. I want to see what DMT feels like. Also, she requested we not ask her a lot of questions, so I could simply enjoy the effects. We were not so off-handed in considering Cassandra's ability to manage high doses of DMT. We knew she could be volatile, and that it was important to be especially careful to avoid making her feel we were forcing anything on her. We didn't want to replay any rape themes in room 531. Cassandra's screening low dose of DMT was mild and pleasant. We met the next day for her non-blind 0.4 milligrams per kilogram high dose. As she began coming down, she said, "Something took my hand and yanked me. It seemed to say, 'Let's go.' Then I started flying through an intense circus-like environment. I've never been that out of body before. First, there was an itchy feeling where the drug went in. We went through a maze at an incredibly fast pace. I say we, because it seemed like I was accompanied. It was cool. There was a crazy circus sideshow, just extravagant. It's hard to describe. They looked like jokers. They were almost performing for me. They were funny looking. Bells on their hats, big noses. However, I had the feeling they could turn on me, a little less than completely friendly. I want to do it again. I want to see if I can slow it down." I called Cassandra the next day. She said, "It's impossible to make sense of it. I'd rather do it again to see what it's like. It's refreshing to get a change of perspective, to see how insignificant my everyday problems are. I felt peaceful this afternoon. There was a brief moment of wanting it to be over because it was so intense, but I remembered to breathe and settled back into it. It's so weird, impossible to prepare for, to know what to expect. I'd rather not introspect too much." She agreed to participate in the tolerance study. Cassandra was in a good mood when we met in room 531 a month later. She began, "I quit my job at the local restaurant where I've been working. I'm not sure what's next in my life now. I met a woman whom I really like. I think about her a lot." I asked, "What are you thinking about the study today?" "Coming down last month from the big dose, I really felt in my body for the first time in my life. I usually live in my head. I remember that feeling. It was therapeutic. I liked the feeling of being in my body." "Can you carry it with you?" She answered, "It's hard to do all at once. I've been out of touch with my body for so long, in a fight with it. I figure it will be a gradual process." It turned out that this first double-blind tolerance day was active drug. We could tell at the 2-minute point, when Cassandra's heart rate and blood pressure jumped dramatically. She didn't say much about her first dose that morning. She seemed to be getting her bearings, keeping her cards close to her chest. As she finished answering the first of the four rating scales, she said, "I thought a lot about my new friend. That was good. But this next one, I want to be all my trip." Once she was able to talk after her second dose, "It's funny. I let go more this time. This was no problem at all. It was all about feeling good. There was no revelation, no meaningful overtones. The body is a real hindrance, isn't it? I definitely felt the presence of others. They were kind to me, nice and caring. They seemed small, as if they could enter my body and mind in that space. There was a total sense of losing my body, but the little presences know how to enter it somehow." "How do you feel about the third dose?" "You should patent it. I guess it's too late for that. If I could only hold on to this feeling, if everybody did this every day, the world would be a much better place. Life would be a lot better. The potential for good is so great. Feeling good within yourself. I guess meditation is supposed to get you to the same place." "I'm not sure that's possible."
"Me neither."
10 minutes into her third dose, Cassandra started smiling. Just then, there also was a horrible coughing out in the hall. "I can still feel it. I hold all this stuff, the shit, in the left side of my abdomen. I got the message this time to let go of all that. I can still feel the relaxation. It's warm and tingly." This seemed like an opening. If she retreated or attacked in response to my next few comments, I'd leave well enough alone. However, she seemed to be asking for some help.
"What do you hold on to?"
"The pain."
"What pain?"
"I guess all the pain." She began crying. "I guess all the pain I ever felt."
"There's a lot there?"
"Yeah."
She began crying more heavily. "It's okay to feel it, and cry, and to let it go, too. That's the good part, to let go of it."
At 15 minutes, she sighed. "I feel like I have a new body. It's so much more aware."
"It is yours."
She laughed dryly, then began crying more deeply. "These aren't sad tears. They are tears of enlightenment. It doesn't matter."
I felt her bristle as she said,
"Yes, it does." Reflecting back to her even more closely, I offered, "I guess they are a cleansing sort of tears."
"Yes. I'll be a guru after this morning. You know how everyone's quest is to find the meaning or the purpose of life? Well, it's to feel this way. Life doesn't cut it normally."
"What do you mean?"
"Everything about life. It's not very empowering. You aren't taught to focus on yourself, to realize the strength you have in yourself. Life throws you into the victim role. I know that's a trite expression, but I think it's true. Things do happen when you're out of control with your life. These DMT experiences are like the height of meditation, accessing inner power and inner strength. You know that question in your rating scale about higher power or God? Well, I'm uncomfortable with that idea, because it implies outside. But I do contact something deeper and more inside. This session was more combined in terms of the presences joining me and me being the focus of it more. The first trip was just me, and the second trip was more the presences. This was a combination.
How do you feel about the fourth dose coming up?
It'll be the best. It'll be even better. I am going deeper and deeper through these layers.
Immediately after giving Cassandra her last dose, people began talking loudly outside the door. At 6 minutes, we heard a huge crash. 5 minutes later, she said, "I feel very loved."
"That's a nice feeling."
"Yes. Warm." She looked sad and tapped the fingers of her right hand against the bed.
I'm feeling a lot.
There was a horrible sound outside the door. Someone drilling in screws. I thought about how incredible it was that our volunteers could disregard all the chaos of a hospital ward and still have such profound experiences. Cassandra lifted the eye shades but kept her eyes closed. Then she opened her eyes half-masked, gazing straight ahead. She looked up at the ceiling and began crying again.
What are you feeling?
Everything will be okay. I don't need to worry about all my doubts. Things like, where will I go? What will I do? It's reassuring.
An optimistic feeling?
Yes, it's very refreshing. It feels like there are thousands and thousands of separate parts of me, and this drug brings them all together. It feels very complete.
You said you felt loved.
It was a feeling in my chest. It was warm. My whole chest felt inflated. It was a really good feeling. I was loved by the entities, or whatever they are. It was very pleasant and comforting.
Cassandra and I spoke a few weeks later by phone. She said, "There have been profound physical changes, very beneficial ones. It feels as if I got my stomach back. Now, for the first time in years, I'm able to breathe deep into my stomach. I'm more optimistic. That's worn off a little bit by now, but not extremely. I can remember the optimism in meditation. It's like having the deepest possible tissue massage. On the third trip, I was really able to let go. I guess I was hurt in there when I was raped. That's where I hide things and protect myself, constantly clenching them. Years of keeping those feelings tightly kept in my abdomen. I feel a lot freer. DMT is far better than any therapy ever was for me. All therapy reminds me of is how bad things were and are. On DMT, I saw and felt myself as a good person, as loved by the DMT elves.
I asked, "Elves?"
There was a sense of many visitors. They were jovial, and they had a great time giving me the experience of being loved. With each dose, there was more and more of a fulfilling, safe, and comfortable, familiar feeling. It would be great to do DMT maybe once a year, to put a perspective on things and see where I'm at and heal me. The freedom in my abdomen is still there. The clenching is back again a little bit, but on a more consistent basis, I can remember that I was able to really clear it out.
I added, "It can be a useful reference point."
Freud coined the term transference, which refers to how people habitually react to others as if they were important figures from that person's earlier life. In therapy, countertransference feelings are those in the therapist similarly projected toward his or her client. Cassandra's life was full of transference feelings for those with whom she became involved. Because there's never transference without countertransference, people reacted just as strongly to her. Sharing her comfort with me could be a trap or an opportunity. We needed to look at our relationship without the confusing dance of transference and countertransference. The next month, Cassandra returned for the second half of the tolerance study. 4 consecutive doses of placebo. After we wrapped up the 4th dose of salt water, I said, "Thanks for your participation."
"Thank you. You've been easy to talk with."
I took this as an opening to do a little bit of work before saying goodbye. She was in a sober and steady condition, so I directly addressed the underlying theme. "I wonder if you had some difficulty at first trusting a male physician who was going to incapacitate you with a drug."
She answered, "I went for it. I trusted you. I never really was worried about it. You changed my life."
Knowing Cassandra put people on pedestals before knocking them down, I countered very carefully, "I helped create the context for you to change your life."
"I guess."
"DMT strips you down to your soul. I know that there is nothing to worry about.
DMT showed me how to see beyond it all. Everything will basically be all right. I remember an idea of Samuel Coleridge. If you have a wonderful dream and bring a rose back with you, and then you wake up and the rose is in your hand, that meant the dream was real. When I came home and saw the bruises and the holes in my arm, I really felt like that, that it really did happen, and that I really was where I was, and felt what I felt. Cassandra's case shows us how critically important it is to respond appropriately to whatever issues DMT raises. I said the bare minimum to keep her process going, without trying to judge, take credit, or otherwise betray her trust. To do so would have derailed the important work she was doing, and most likely she'd experience it as another violation of her integrity. With Cassandra, there was a blending of several different themes. However, the primary one seems to have been re-encountering the psychological trauma of her rape through the symptom of her abdominal pain. DMT made it easier for her to make the emotional contact with what her physical pain represented, and indeed, where it began. The spirit molecule helped her by demonstrating that she could lose control, particularly around a powerful man, and be safe and loved at the same time. The issues of who loved her and told her she was good, and the nature of that love, take us into other categories, such as contact with beings and spirituality. Both Marcia and Cassandra met up with clowns and presences who seemed to reside somewhere other than room 531. Let's now examine these other worlds and their inhabitants to which the spirit molecule may lead us. They are neither personal nor transpersonal in nature. Rather, they are invisible, and for the volunteers and research team, quite startling and unexpected.